I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. This is Fronteras, a program about issues along the U.S.-Mexico border and changing demographics in the Southwest. In 1938, 10,000 pecan shellers in San Antonio went on strike. These were not your typical blue-collar teamsters. They were women, children, the elderly, primarily Mexican or Mexican-American, and impoverished. The shellers worked in enclosed rooms with little ventilation and no sanitary facilities. Pecan dust was everywhere. That led to high incidence of lung disease like asthma and tuberculosis. Southern Pecan Shelling Company, owned by Julius Seligman and Joe Freeman, did not take advantage of shelling machines available to them at the time. Instead, they took advantage of workers who were paid pennies per pounds of pecans shelled by hand. The workers went on strike. Local labor and civil rights leader Emma Tenayuca took up their cause. Filmmaker Ann Lewis's new documentary, A Strike and an Uprising in Texas, covers two monumental worker uprisings in the Lone Star State, the 1938 pecan sheller strike and a more recent 1987 march by university employees in Nacogdoches. Lewis says the pecan sheller strike grew out of the fact that half of the pecans in the U.S. were shelled in San Antonio at the time.
So it was a huge, important industry that these women were working in a very marginal way. And the guy that ran Southern Pecan Shelling, which was the largest of these factories, named Seligman, was basically making a killing during the Depression off starvation wages. There were enough people in San Antonio that he could exploit, that he could not mechanize where other people did mechanize. So this is a real story of corporate greed. This is not marginal. Now, one of the things that was true about the industry, though, was it was very fragmented. In other words, you didn't have a situation like you'd have at Ford Motor, where everybody was in the same building and so forth. Instead, people were working for these very small managers, for the most part. Some were even shelling pecans in their homes and then taking them to the place to have them weighed. So there was this kind of piecework, fragmented workforce. And most people were also migrant workers. During the summer, they'd go harvest, come home to San Antonio, and then shell pecans as a means of income. So it was temporary, fragmented income. And I think what really held them together, unlike other labor events, which were much more centered around workplace, was the community itself, was a real sense of family structure and community. So Emma Tenayuca comes out of a cigar strike and also comes out of a very political background. Her grandfather took her to the plaza, and she listened to mutualistas and all kinds of different political speeches. Probably where she becomes more of a leader is in the Workers' Alliance. And the Workers' Alliance was an organization for unemployed people during the Depression to begin getting the kind of compensation, particularly Latinos, getting the kind of compensation that they deserved. When we hit the pecan sheller strike, that's 38. I think she was in her early 20s at that point. And the people, according to everybody that I talked to, absolutely loved her. I mean, she was the community leader. She was to the left. She was fiery. She was really, really important. And I think it's interesting that you would have that popular leader of a strike kind of in the public eye, in the workers' eye, you know, moving things forward.
Well, this particular strike sort of kick-started the civil rights movement for Mexican Americans and Mexican nationals living in the United States. And this was a point where that particular population, which felt oppressed, repressed, they felt, we have some power. we can do something. Where did that momentum go from 1938? Because it took a while between that period and the movement that Cesar Chavez took mm-hmm. over a few decades later. Why the gap? Or was there not a gap, but were there other leaders like Emma Tenayuca who are sort of riding under the radar until a big figure like Cesar Chavez comes and changes the picture?
What happened, I think, was the Second World War. So you have movement, and I think some of it heads more into questions of civil rights than into labor immediately following the war. But you also have massive repression in the 50s and in late 40s. And it's not until the civil rights movement of the 60s that really gets broken. The young people take over, right? So, I mean, I think you begin seeing an emergence of protest and movement in the 60s that finally breaks that repression. Emma Tenayuca gets rediscovered really in the early 80s by scholars who are saying, wait a moment, there's this woman who led an incredible strike and we don't know anything about her. So that history along with that social repression is also repressed.
So also in your movie, A Strike and an Uprising in Texas, you focus on another strike, which is a little bit more closer to modern day. It's one that happened in 1987 at Stephen F. Austin State University in Nacogdoches. That has mm-hmm. to do with black workers at the university who put up their own uprising. So give us a little bit of a background on that, please.
Well, you know, for me, it's really interesting because even though it's like 40 years later, it goes back even further because it really is the remnants of slavery. And again, this is all from oral history. But in the 70s, Stephen F. Austin State University was not paying an hourly wage to its employees. That, to me, is profoundly disturbing. So, in other words, if you were a cook at Stephen F. Austin State University or somebody who cleaned the dormitories and the so forth, you were paid $75 every 2 weeks, no matter how many hours you worked. So it's really a plantation system. And so there was this one woman, Annie Mae Carpenter, who worked at Stephen F. Austin State University for many, many years. And she cleaned the president's house as part of her job. She cleaned the president's house of the university. And then she went on to clean three other buildings at the university. And she was elderly and very dignified and African-American. All of the workers that I came in contact with were African-American. One day, she's told to go in and clean the male student dormitory bathrooms, and she refused. Well, there's a lot of speculation about why she would refuse, but the people that I spoke to, there was a history in Nacogdoches, as in all of the South, certainly, of sexual abuse of black women. You know, whether she would have been raped or just teased unmercifully or in some way threatened, you know, seemed likely. And so she refused, and they fired her. And that became a class action suit against the university. And so what they did was the university, being part of the University of Texas, fought this class and this discrimination suit. And they fought it with everything they had. They fought it with their own attorneys. The attorney for the workers there was Larry Daves, and they were throwing these high-powered government lawyers at this case. So they'd win a little piece of it, and then they'd lose something. And this went on and on and on until finally there was this idea. There was a new young organizer at that time who came into town. And he and Daves began talking to each other, and they decided that perhaps the thing to do is to organize a labor union. So they call people together, and about 400 people joined the union in one day because it was a community-based union.
So give us a time span. This all began in 1973.
Right.
So how long did it take from the time that Annie Mae Carpenter was fired to where all the lawsuits gave and take up into where that union was created?
Well, they began creating a union in about 82 or 83.
So that was 10 years already.
It was 10 years already. That's right, the beginning of organizing public workers in Texas. So they were not a union the way we think of unions as having collective bargaining, because it's illegal to have collective bargaining in the state of Texas as a public worker. What happened was when they began really exerting themselves and getting some power, finally they won the lawsuit. But the university just kind of stalled on paying back pay for workers. So they had to put some more pressure on. And then what the university did was they privatized the food service workers, who were the core of the union organizing campaign. So they basically privatized them, which meant that as public workers, they couldn't be organized in the same way.
So whatever became of Annie Mae Carpenter?
She kind of vanishes into this movement. You know, people remembered her. In some ways, she's a kind of a Rosa Parks figure for me, you know, this incredibly courageous individual. But she becomes a part of that movement, and she retired. I don't know if she ever got her back pay, and certainly people didn't get as much as they should have by the time it was all over.
We've been speaking with filmmaker Ann Lewis, whose films focus on social action, human rights, and environmental justice. Her 2018 documentary is A Strike and an Uprising in Texas. More of our conversation is online at tpr.org. Still to come on Fronteras.
There's a lot more secret history in San Antonio to be uncovered and to be told and made not secret.
David Martin Davies joins us to talk about his new comic, San Antonio Secret History. Stay with us. Welcome back to Fronteras. I'm Norma Martinez. There's much more we ought to remember about San Antonio than the Alamo, like in 1957, when State Senator Henry B. Gonzalez spoke for 36 hours straight in opposition to a battery of bills designed to prevent desegregation in Texas. It's events like these that are hiding away in the crevices of the city's vast history. Texas Public Radio's David Martin Davies helps fill in the gaps with his self-published comic, San Antonio, Secret History. Davies tells us his fascination with the Alamo City's little-told stories lies with an awful example of racism and segregation in the 1950s.
While I was working on another story, doing historic research, going through the archive at the San Antonio Public Library, I came across, just happenstance, across a headline and a picture and this local pools, San Antonio pools, are now whites only. And this was a headline from Juneteenth, 1957. And I read the story, and it was about how six African-American children go to Woodlawn Pool, and they jump in the water. There was Jim Crow here in San Antonio at the time, and it was understood that these were whites-only pools, but there was no actual ordinance prohibiting that. And it was not long after Brown v. Board of Education, the Supreme Court decision. And so this was a challenge to this local segregation of a public space. And it was quite a kerfuffle, local kerfuffle. The city council met in an emergency meeting that day, and they shut down the pools entirely across the city, allegedly for repair. They passed an emergency ordinance prohibiting African Americans from using these pools locally. I grew up in these pools. I swam in these pools. I learned to swim there. I was a lifeguard there. I had no idea that this had happened. And it struck me. That night, someone burnt a cross in front of the pool. The Ku Klux Klan. And that was not a small thing. That is a very overt threat of violence against the community. But the San Antonio's community, the NAACP, went forward and they challenged this, and they went to federal court. And just as they were about to go to federal court on this, San Antonio changed the ordinance and they dropped it. And it was forgotten. There's nothing at the pool. There's no historic marker. I was at the pool just the other day talking to the manager of the pool, and he had no idea. He didn't know what this was. People need to know this, and we need to remember these kids. And they're adults now. I wish I knew who they were, and we need to celebrate them. And the San Antonio is full of stuff like this. Supreme Court decisions and challenges and efforts to organize. I just think that this should be part of our history, just as well known as anything else that we celebrate in San Antonio.
So this could have easily been, you know, maybe sort of a picture book, but instead you chose to make it a comic. And I know you have an interest in comics. How does that interest go back in your life?
In the 1920s, 30s, there used to be this book called Texas History Movies. It was published by the Magnolia Oil Company, and it was printed and distributed to public schools across Texas. And this was a comic book that told the history of Texas, but it told it in a very Anglo-centric point of view, which, of course, is something that you would expect for that day and age. A lot of stereotypical depictions of people of color. So telling Texas history in using a comic book form is not new. What I wanted to do is take a look at how this book created a foundation and crystallized a view of Texas history, that one that is still told today and is very strong, and say, well, how can we turn this on its head? Why are images so powerful? What can we do in order to inform adults and children about their own history and about themselves? So I think that creating a new set of iconic images, the artist Hector Garza did a fantastic job in crafting these incredible images that I think are seared into the brain. Some are comical, some are very serious. His style is taking Mexican iconography and also doing it in sort of a hybrid way that also uses Western culture, pop culture influences, and also like Hanna-Barbera type cute images, and smashes them all together and creates something totally new and original. And I thought that would work.
It's also a self-published comic. So why did you choose to bypass the whole publishing mess?
There was some talk about going to publishers to do this. The more that talk evolved, the more complicated things got and the more control that was being lost along the way. And I didn't want to do it that way. I mean, this is a punk rock kind of publishing effort, which is just do it. I was able to maintain the control and get it done and keep it in-house. So that's what I wanted to do.
Well, pretty much the Alamo is the central point of history for San Antonio. But as you've uncovered in this book, there is so much more to this city than the common knowledge. And as you were mentioning, Supreme Court rulings, San Antonio has played a really central role in a lot of these decisions. The Edgewood Lanier High School walkouts in 1968 led to school funding reform. There was another case that was argued by Gus Garcia in 1954 that Mexican Americans are entitled to equal protection under the law. And even after that, there was another Supreme Court decision that decided that there was no fundamental right to an education. That case grew out of San Antonio, and that was in 1973. So how difficult was it for you to dig up all this information? Where did you find it?
It was just digging through newspapers, you know, hitting the Google, doing my job, and collecting these stories over the years. You come across something like Rodriguez versus San Antonio, and you say, oh, what is that? We have to know these things. We have to know the San Antonio roots. This informs us of our city and our community, and we should know the heroes and the villains of San Antonio's past. There's a lot more secret history in San Antonio to be uncovered and to be told and made not secret. You know, when we say it's secret history, this is only secret to some people. Others, they know these stories. A lot of these stories are told in the kitchens and over the Domino's tables and told, you know, all the time among families that live this history. What we want to do is take it out of that private area and make this part of our public history so that everyone knows about it and that everyone can feel pride in the San Antonio history, one that works towards more equality, greater access to education, and economic opportunity.
We've been talking with Texas Public Radio's David Martin Davies. His new self-published comic, San Antonio's Secret History, is illustrated by Hector Garza. Thanks for joining us this week on Fronteras. You can find the show under the Programs tab on our website, tpr.org, and wherever you get your podcasts. Fronteras is produced by Norma Martinez and Lauren Terrazas. Our executive producer is Dan Katz. Our digital editor is Vince Kong. Charanga Cakewalk composed our theme music. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.